shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians, called to a higher level of understanding, will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Good evening. This is Brother Mike welcoming you to another one of our first of the month live Kingdom Concepts broadcasts. We had a little trouble getting on tonight because lightning hit and destroyed my computer, my modem, and a couple of my best phones and a number of other things, including my well pump. But anyway, I'm on a substitute computer and we're back on the air tonight. We're on WWCR 4.840 megahertz and 5.890 megahertz. That's transmitters 3 and 4. And we're on WBCQ 7.490 megahertz. Both of those stations have internet links, and you can go directly to our website, kingidentity.com, kingidentity.com. Go to our radio page, and then down at the bottom you'll see a listen live button, and you can also see our phone number if you'd like to join the conversation tonight. That's 877-924-7722. That's a toll-free number, 877-924-7722. You can remember that by 877-YAWS-RACE. Also, if our foreign listeners or even those of you domestically would like to call direct, you can call 678-949-5091. Guest tonight, we've tried to have him on several times since he was with us about 3 years ago, I believe. He's calling all the way from England, where it's 4 a.m. He's the assistant editor of Heritage and Destiny magazine. He's a man well informed of the political situation in both the UK and in Europe. And I'd like to welcome back to the broadcast Peter Rushton.
Thank you very much, Mike. It's good to be here again.
Well, it's good to have you. I know a lot has taken place since you were last on the air with us. Would you like to kind of summarize what's currently taking place in the UK?
Sure, Mike. Well, the big story at the moment here in the UK and across Europe is that this month is the month of the elections to the European Parliament, and many people in the mainstream media, and even occasionally I see in the US, in US newspapers, in the New York Times and some of the mainstream papers, are focusing on what they think is a threat of what they call the far right doing very well in these elections in some European countries, and creating for the first time a multinational bloc across Europe of nationalist parties, of parties that are resisting the one world order plan, or resisting the plan of the European Union level to break down our national identities and break down our racial identities. Now, that sounds like it should be good news, and in some ways it is good news. But within that story, sadly, there's still a picture of the long-term confusion of our people, and sections of the so-called nationalist movement are not immune from that confusion that's been spread right from the top of our political leadership, especially on racial matters. You know, in Europe, as some of your listeners will know, some of these things you can't even talk about in Europe. Unlike in the US, where you've got constitutional freedom of speech, in Europe, different countries of Europe, there are different laws that restrict what you can say on these crucial political matters. that say that you're trying to incite racial hatred if you even refer to certain matters, or if you even speak about historical matters sometimes, that is classed as inciting racial hatred, and you can be given a prison sentence for it. It's quite an oppressive situation here in Europe, and even in this, even at this time when things seem to be looking up, and there seems to be some light on the horizon, there's still confusion, particularly over people who some of the leaders of the so-called right-wing movement in Europe have been persuaded that they should talk only about Islam and only about Muslims and not about broader racial questions and certainly not about Jews. Now, I don't know whether you have this problem over in the United States to the same extent of people seeking to channel the debate, you know, and take the debate away from essential questions.
I actually believe that the Jews are behind the heavy anti-Muslim situation, because at the same time they speak of that, they're speaking about fundamentalists of all religions, and people don't realize it. And some of the Muslim laws, Sharia law, reflects our own traditional laws of Christianity, which they are trying to break down everywhere. So I'm certainly against other religions and other races, but I think that it's a smokescreen to cover up the real problem. And like in your country, political correctness takes place among the politicians, the media, the schools, etc. We have true racial nationalists, which are just a small remnant, but then we have kosher conservatives or the establishment type conservative parties, which won't touch a racial matter or a Jewish matter specifically with a 10-foot pole.
I think that's an interesting point you make there about the moral questions that obviously politics touches on at times, the regulation of moral behavior. Because in Europe, one of the countries where this so-called threat of the far right, so-called threat of nationalism has been most prominent is in Holland, where the party of a man called Geert Wilders has been one of the best known parties in Europe. And sadly, some parties such as Marine Le Pen's Front National in France, they've been drawn into alliances with Wilders and see a sort of coalition with the Wilders type of parties as being the way to go. What they fail to appreciate is that Geert Wilders in Holland and his anti-Muslim coalition in Holland, a lot of those people were against Muslims because they were a threat to Dutch liberalism. They were a threat to Dutch secular liberalism. You know, they were a threat to homosexuals. They were a threat to drug takers. They were against all of the things that we're against. They weren't hostile to Muslims because they were hostile to immigration. On the contrary, these types of people say immigrants would be welcome as long as they fit in this instance with Wilders' party, with Dutch values. And Holland has for many years been in the vanguard of European liberalism, has been the most liberal country in Europe on various moral questions. So their anti-Islamic strategy is the very opposite of what a healthy politics would be about, of what a healthy racial politics and a healthy moral politics would be about. And it's really tragic to see some of our leaders in the movement being drawn down that path. And, of course, the media are very keen to encourage this type of confusion and hype up this Wilders type of politics, this Dutch Freedom Party type of politics. Because they can see that this is a blind alley for the racial nationalist movement. It will divide us because people think, well, if that sort of thing wins you some sort of electoral success, broadens your electoral base, why not go for it? But what they don't realize is it's taking us in precisely the opposite direction to the direction that a healthy racial politics would be going on. So that's all very sad. The positive part of it, of course, is that at least some people are talking about immigration and racial issues. And whatever the media might want to control, and whatever false leaders might want to control, once ordinary people start to talk about these issues and start to shed the fear of discussing these issues, there's at least the potential that they'll come up with the right answers. That once there are no longer forbidden topics, there's at least the potential for making some sort of progress. So, on balance, we're in a better position now than we were, say, 20 years ago, in terms of people being prepared to discuss things. Where, of course, we're in a worse position is that there have been millions more immigrants since that has been in the past 20 to 25 years. Just in the years of Tony Blair's Labour government alone, roughly from 1997 to 2010, so roughly the first decade of this century, there were another 4 million or so immigrants came into the UK. And this is in a country with a population of less than 70 million. You know, in the context of the whole of the USA, 4 million might not sound a lot. In the context of the UK, it's a lot of people.
We've got an invasion of Mexicans coming into this country, so it would be your Pakistanis and Indians and whatever else is invading the UK.
Mm.
What about some of the other nationalist parties in Europe, such as Jobbik, I believe it's pronounced?
Yeah, now Jobbik is an excellent and probably the brightest prospect for Europe is in Hungary, where Jobbik is completely unafraid to address fundamental issues. They're not going to get drawn down the Islamo-obsessive blind alley, as I call it. They, partly for reasons to do with the history of Hungary, of course. Hungary, as many of you listeners will know, tried in 1956 to throw off the yoke of Stalinist communism. And people in Hungary were very well aware, and this is where I have to be very careful what I say about this for legal reasons in Europe, but people in Hungary were very well aware of the racial and religious background of the type of people who were behind communism in Eastern Europe. And their attempt at a revolution in 1956, which was eventually crushed, brutally crushed by the Stalinists, was to a very large extent a racial counter-revolution as well, an attempt to throw off their real oppressors. So the people in Jobbik and the ideological mentors of Jobbik are fully aware of the bigger picture. So when you get a party like Jobbik polling, say, 20% of the vote in that country, which it has done in recent years, and getting significant numbers of members of parliament and members of the European Parliament, then, and in Hungary as well, they've got two elections this year, both for their own parliament in their own country and for their segment of the European Parliament. So it's doubly important what's happening in Hungary this year. And they can be a beacon, if you like. Their success can be a beacon for other European countries to say, look, you don't have to censor yourself. You don't have to follow a path of what we could call kosher nationalism, you know. You can follow a fully historically aware path of racial nationalism, and you can succeed. But similarly, of course, the Golden Dawn Party in Greece has been tremendously successful despite both legal oppression and, only a few months ago, two of their leading activists being shot dead outside their party offices. Real sort of gangster oppression, as well as legal oppression. And in many cases, of course, these are being controlled by the same people. The legal oppression and illegal violent oppression are just two sides of the same coin in places like Athens. But the voters there are prepared to defy that. The voters and the leaders of Jobbik in Hungary are prepared to defy political correctness as well. And let us hope that that's a beacon for Europeans and ultimately for people of European stock elsewhere in the world.
What about in England, the true racial nationalists versus the nationalists who are kind of establishment types? The recent elections had UKIP, the Independent Party, come up in votes, but at the same time, I guess they restrict what they speak on.
UKIP very much do, yes. I mean, UKIP is a good example of the positive part of UKIP's success is that at least they free up some political space. They get people no longer just used to voting for the same old parties. You know, for many years in the UK, it was in some ways similar to the US, that people spent their entire lives identified as, in this country, Labour or Conservative, just as in the US they'd be identified as Democrats or Republicans. And it was almost a sort of tribal allegiance. It didn't reflect any serious political thinking, and that political duopoly really killed any. It was rather like in Alice in Wonderland, Tweedledum and Tweedledee. You know, they were the two twins of the establishment, and they offered no real choice at all. Now, when UKIP come along and break up that comfortable party deal, then setting aside for a moment the problems that I would have with UKIP's own leadership and UKIP's own ideology, at least that breaks up the comfortable deal, starts people thinking seriously, opens up the potential for some sort of real debate. The difficulty is that UKIP really is focused very narrowly on the issue of the European Union and the European Union, the European Federalist Project, as people often call it. Now, that's an important issue because it's an important segment of trying to deny our identity. Just as in the broader sense, if they have a One World Project, a United Nations Project, that denies our identity. We're all supposed to be subsumed into being one big happy human family, as though there was no difference between races, no difference between cultures, no fundamental biological differences between peoples. All of the facts, the facts of racial reality, are denied when we are subsumed into one great mass. And of course, in the practical political sense, once you are locked into a treaty organization, the European Union lays down or seeks to lay down the political parameters, the boundaries of accepted political debate. So resisting that is very important. The problem, of course, is that beyond that, UKIP do censor themselves tremendously, even to a rather ridiculous extent. I had an example just the other day, where UKIP will actually ban anybody who was ever a member of the British National Party, let's say, from joining them. I spoke just recently to someone I know in the north of England who was at one time a leading activist in the BNP, which is a more hardline party. I mean, the BNP itself, which is another issue, the BNP leadership itself got taken down some very wrong paths and some very corrupt paths in terms of the individual who was leading it, and that's why a lot of people left the BNP. But at least ideologically it was a more hardline, at least in its origins, a more hardline, genuine racial nationalist party. But various people...
John Tyndall.
Very much so under JT. John Tyndall was a good friend of mine and a very great writer, a very great man, yeah. He established the British National Party just over 30 years ago, and it was built on very solid ideological foundations. But when it got subverted, and as a result of the subversion of that party, John Tyndall himself died in 2005. under his successor, Nick Griffin, that party was subverted, both politically and financially and in other ways. And so various people who had been in that party looked for another political home. One man I know, as I say, in the north of England, who was had been a key activist in that party, he tried to join UKIP just to do something for his community. He knew that UKIP had its limitations, but on a local level in his community in the north, he wanted to make some contribution in his local council. And UKIP wouldn't allow him to join. Ironically, the Conservative Party, which is meant to be a much milder version of UKIP, they would allow him to join. So that just illustrates, and he's now a Conservative council candidate for the local council up in Lancashire. So it just illustrates the absurd lengths to which UKIP is prepared to go to, if you like, to genuflect to political correctness, to bow down before our political masters, that they won't even allow certain people who've been in the BNP to join them. And in all sorts of other ways, they seek to channel debate within that party solely onto the European issue. Now, of course,
I believe you're affiliated with the England First Party. Has that been making any inroads?
Yeah, well, the situation now with the England First Party and with other movements that had, in different parts of the UK, that had broken away from the BNP, we are now looking towards the, let's say, a post-Griffin, post-BNP future, where we can bring together all the various fractured segments of our movement, that all the genuine people in the movement who've left either through ideological disillusionment with the BNP or with disillusionment with the financial corruption of the BNP, and to try and bring those people together. Now, in terms of the practicalities of that, that just to sit down and assess where we are, that has to be done after this year's elections. This year's elections for true racial nationalists in this country will be very difficult ones, because we're in a time of transition. Because we've got one party, the BNP, dying. We've got another party that isn't really a racial nationalist party, UKIP, picking itself up, but trying to expel or exclude anybody who's a genuine racial nationalist. So we're in a period of flux and confusion here in the UK of our movement. And really, I was speaking to a retiring MEP just the other week about this. We are going to need to organize ourselves and sit down with the various leaders of different factions, some of whom have had differences with each other over things that aren't really important and that can easily be resolved. Set those differences aside and reforge a movement that really stands up for genuine racial nationalism in this country. If you like, you spoke about Jobbik in Hungary, a party that can do for the British people what Jobbik is doing for the people of Hungary. That's what we need to have after these elections. And really, when we survey the battleground after the May elections, will be the time to pick ourselves up, recognize the mistakes that have gone on since Nick Griffin replaced John Tyndall as leader of the BNP, the errors that have been made in our movement, and where we can go from there, the time, what positive progress we can make, having recognized our past errors.
Here in the U.S., we've had problems with elections, among other things, because of the invasion of Mexicans and the other Hispanics, so whites are getting smaller and smaller. What are the demographic changes in England doing to the elections?
Well, it's essentially one big difference between the UK and the US is that our demographic transformation didn't really begin until the late 1940s. Until the late 1940s, we were essentially a white country. Okay, because we were a big trading nation, and the various seaports in Liverpool and London, there'd be a tiny number of non-whites who would have been serving on merchant ships and what have you, and would end up settling in those seaports. But it was not a significant demographic factor. What happened after the Second World War was that, very foolishly, they brought in the British Nationality Act, which gave the right to settle here, literally to anybody across the British Empire who was a British subject, who was a subject of the British Empire, could just come back here. So for many years, that was the situation after 1948. And so, of course, that began with blacks from the West Indies, from the islands of the West Indies, started to come here in the end of the 1940s and through the 1950s, and then you had a large-scale Asian immigration from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh through the 1960s and 1970s, and Asians from parts of Africa coming here in the late 60s, early 70s, and then latterly, of course, you've had all sorts of people from different corners of Africa coming here as well. So the extraordinary thing here in London, and today I'm speaking to you from London, in this city, there's actual racial conflict between different types of blacks, between the Afro-Caribbeans from the various Caribbean islands like Jamaica and Barbados, who've been here, whose families have been here since the 40s and 50s, and the Africans who come over here in the last 10 or 20 years. And those groups will actually, you know, are viciously hostile to each other. And it's quite common here in London for there to be murders of one, with one gang of blacks attacking another gang of blacks, partly for control of organized crime and partly just racial and cultural hostility. So the inner city of London really is, if you were to come from one of the very multiracial cities of the US, you would not be surprised to see what inner London is like. But if you'd been brought up with a traditional idea of what London was like, you'd be quite shocked, and some tourists must be quite shocked at the racial makeup of inner London when they arrive here. So I was just going to say, many of the old established white families in parts of inner London, particularly, you know, the famous East End of London, the Cockneys of the East End of London, they fled that area and moved out further east into outer London and even into the counties surrounding London, the outer suburbs. I think you get this phenomenon sometimes in US cities as well, don't you? What they term white flight of people fleeing the area. But at least because it only started in the late 1940s in this country, our racial problems are not quite as deeply embedded as they are in the US, where obviously it goes back well over a century in the U.S., doesn't it, with here, particularly with the large black populations.
Well, it also affects the white culture. How does it affect the white culture there in Europe?
Yeah, now that's a very interesting point, Mike. Yeah, that is just starting. If you'd asked me that question 20 years ago, I would have said there's a very clearly defined black culture in the cities and a very clearly defined white culture, even among young people. But just in recent years, and not just in London, right across the UK, there's, as a result of a pretty intensive effort by the popular culture industry, the white culture among young people has become very, very much influenced by black culture. And even among, we were talking about Muslims earlier on, even among young people from Pakistani or Indian backgrounds, they start to behave and adopt a type of gang mentality that's influenced by the style and the culture of, a ghetto black in an American city. That culture has been spread really through pretty much throughout the white world among young people. Popular cultural norms that are part of the most criminal elements of American big city black culture are now spread not just among young whites in America, but young whites throughout the white world, and certainly here in England, and particularly among young working class whites. They think that this is the way to behave. Now the question is, because that's very much a recent trend here, very much in the last 10 to 20 years, especially the last 10 years, is it a reversible trend?
I noticed that just like the U.S., they're pushing homosexual marriage in the U.K. And
oh, yeah. That's...
They had a fit the other day, the liberal press, about, I believe the prime minister said something about it being a Christian country.
Yes,
and
yes.
I saw a while back, this has been quite a few months back, I saw the installation of the Archbishop of Canterbury in the Church of England.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a bunch of blacks jumping around, I guess, witch doctors in their skirts and beating on their tom-toms, and I thought, how could England go this far?
Yeah, it really is quite shocking. And this is part of the problem when someone like David Cameron, that our Prime Minister, talks about the UK being a Christian country. What he means is a Christian country of that type. He is thinking of the ultra-liberal, ultra-so-called tolerant. They use this word tolerant. But, of course, in my experience, there's nothing more intolerant than a modern secularized liberal, and that includes the liberal Christians. Their intolerance is so extreme that if someone were simply to put an alternative point of view on issues such as homosexuality, they would absolutely throw a fit. They would be they would literally be shocked, fainting away, screaming that somebody could dare to express such a racist, heterosexist, all these terms that are used to demonize anybody expressing views that only a couple of generations back would have been the mainstream views in this country, and I would imagine the mainstream views in the U.S. as well.
Really, mainstream views biblically. I know that we teach that under God's laws, the homosexuals to be put to death, and I'd probably be arrested if I taught that over there in the U.K.
Oh, I'm sure you would be arrested for saying that in the UK. Yes, that wouldn't just cause them to faint away. It'd cause them to send you to prison. Yeah, the Church of England has been very much in the forefront of that. Of course, it's interesting to see you mentioned Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and when people talk about Britain being a Christian country, of course. That means two things. Not only does it mean our Christian heritage going back really back much more than a millennium, you know, back to St. Augustine and back beyond the medieval monks like Bede who were writing ecclesiastical histories well over a millennium ago. What that means specifically is that we have an established church in this country. And this is where it starts to get quite dangerous, politicians talking about it being a Christian country. And we were saying earlier about politicians speaking out against Islam, because where you have one denomination of Christianity that is actually regarded as the state church, and which gets subsidies to run schools and things like that, that crosses a certain sort of boundary of church and state that, of course, you don't have in the U.S. That has a certain established position. The big danger of that is that when the wrong sort of people capture that established church, you've got big problems, and they're able to advance their agenda in quite a powerful way. I don't know whether you read in the U.S. about Justin Welby's family background. His family haven't been Christian all that far back. If you go back a couple of generations in his family, they were European Jews. And his father, Gavin Welby, spent a lot of time in the U.S. starting off in the Prohibition era, associating with U.S. gangsters. Yeah, so the Welby family, the family of our Archbishop, has quite a colourful background.
I think they're trying to infiltrate all the Christian churches they have for some time. The Pope has, as I recall, it was the Pope who had a mother who was Jewish.
Really? That's interesting. I didn't know that. This is the present Pope.
I believe so. I might be thinking of somebody else, but I saw an article recently.
Well, he's certainly,
Prime Minister is going, to, at least according to an article we saw in the U.S., going around looking for Holocaust survivors in England so he can, I don't know, reward them or something.
Yeah, well, that's a tremendous cult. The cult of the Holocaust victim, right across Europe. Some people say that Holocaustianity has replaced Christianity. You know that Auschwitz has replaced Calvary. This is the only people who are worshipped are those who are the survivors, as you say. This has really taken over large parts of our education system, taking children on trips to Auschwitz, etc. And that's right across Europe now. Part of that is to instill one big guilt trip in the whole of the white race worldwide. That if we are to be labelled as the people who murdered 6 million Jews, then not only does that make modern-day Jews and the modern-day state of Israel immune from criticism, it means that the self-confidence of European and European-American children, if they're constantly being told that their people were responsible for this greatest crime in history, what does that do to their confidence as a people? And the moment anybody comes along and says, well, you as a people should be standing up for your interests and fighting for your interests, the alarm bells are meant to go off in their head. You know, this is how the brainwashing works. The alarm bells are meant to go off and they're meant to think, oh no, the moment we go down that route of nationalism, of racial nationalism, or of standing up with pride in ourselves, that leads straight to committing horrible crimes and putting people into gas chambers.
I knew a German woman who grew up during World War II, and after the war, when she was still a child, they would herd all the children into the auditorium and show them brainwashing films and guilt films and then just be silent about it and send them back to their classrooms. So she actually grew up with a guilt feeling until I showed her Triumph of the Will. She kind of changed her mind.
I was just going to say that there was a bit of a time lag between doing that to the people actually in Germany immediately after the war and starting to spread it here in the UK. I think the reason why they didn't push the whole Holocaustianity business too aggressively to British people straight after the war was that they were a little bit scared of people thinking, you know, people who'd lost relatives or people who'd suffered horrible injuries during that war. The last thing they wanted those people to start to think was that this war had been fought for the benefit of international Jewry. So for about 30 years after the Second World War, most of the propaganda in Britain about that conflict was focused on heroic Britons standing up to the Huns, standing up to Germans. And the Jewish aspect of it was, if anything, played slightly down in the propaganda war. It was only when that wartime generation was passing away, and that when the danger of any sort of backlash, because of course there'd been, after the First World War, A very short time after the First World War, there'd been a backlash against the very idea of a European Brothers' War, and people started to regard that war as a terrible waste. In many ways, a century on, people still do regard that First World War as a tragic and unnecessary European Civil War. The last thing they could afford, was for that perception to take root about the Second World War as well.
We're over halfway through the broadcast, and I haven't asked you yet to give some contact information if people would like to get Heritage and Destiny or some other content.
Yeah, the best way of getting in touch with the magazine and getting sort of details about the sort of stuff that appears in the magazine, sample articles and such things, is to go to our website, which is www.heritageanddestiny.com. That's heritageanddestiny, all one word, .com. There you'll find news articles updated just for the website, also substantial excerpts from past issues of the magazine, and information about forthcoming issues. We'll just be going to press with a new issue just next week, focusing on a preview of the European elections, the upcoming European elections, and we've done a sort of A to Z guide of the different European countries, explaining when the media tell you about this supposed far right, you know, what type of parties are these? Are they parties like you mentioned UKIP earlier on, who are just hostile to the European Federalist Project? Are they parties that are obsessed by Islam, or are they parties that have a deeper racial nationalist commitment and a broader historical vision? So we're publishing that guide in our next issue, which is the May June issue, and you can find that details on the web.
You have a number of articles that are a large variety of topics, and they're all very interesting.
Yeah.
I would recommend the magazine to anybody.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Let me give my phone number out again in case anybody would like to call us tonight and join the broadcast. The number, the toll-free number, is 877-924-7722. 877-924-7722. 877-YAWS-RACE. If you would like to call direct, you can call 678-949-5091. That would be for our listeners in Europe, and the U.S. can also call that number. And I see we got a caller as I speak. It's from, it looks like, Marionette, Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's it.
Welcome to the broadcast.
Well, I never heard your show before, and I was finding it quite interesting. You're talking about the Second World War and how the First World War was a waste. The answer is in the papers by Albert Pike. He was a Confederate general, and about 1875, he wrote the three papers about the starting the First World War, the consequences, Second World War consequences, and the Third World War is with Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And we have Barry Satoro, our president, you know, raised in a mosque. I mean, it all adds up. You know, it's coming.
Yeah, and of course, who are the sort of people that are wanting to incite this type of conflict and distract us from the racial issues that we face? We could end up with a sort of Third World War developing in Syria now, where there's all sorts of confusion, because, of course, we are backing one Muslim faction against another Muslim faction, and you say that...
It's for the elimination of Christians. You know, Syria was one-third Christian, and most of them lived in Aleppo. Aleppo was destroyed. Same thing in Baghdad. Under Saddam, there was 300 Christian churches. and they were all destroyed.
Absolutely tragic. Absolutely tragic, the fate of Christians in that region, yeah. And
this is part of
the same race
as Islam. Pardon?
This same race has been causing war since the beginning of time. As Henry Ford said, wars are Jewish harvest. It's my understanding that during World War II that they originally planned to use the nuclear bomb on a city that had Buddha statues or something like that, and that later they did Hiroshima and Nagasaki because that was the highest concentration of professing Christians. So this is nothing new, and of course they're trying to get us in a war now with Iran.
Oh yeah. Yeah. This whole thing really destabilized a basically quiet and well-off country as Libya, you know, and Egypt, you know, the Arab Spring, how Peter so proclaimed it as being a wonderful deal, and oh my goodness. But I believe I just got done reading Revelations, and it's forming up. It's very interesting. So we have all these masses of humanity. Then we got Ukraine. Quite interesting, isn't it? These people are very evil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think that Albert Pike has a statue, several statues in Washington, D.C., actually. And the one was by the National Masonic Temple, of course. And, yeah, you can go online and just hit up Albert Pike and just find a way and you'll see his papers. And you read them and it's happening. It happened just like they dictated.
I believe Adam Weishaupt back in 1776 took over the Masonic organization there in Europe. Anyway, we have another caller and I'd like to thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks very much. Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
We have a caller from Granville, Illinois. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. I was listening to the program tonight, and, you know, I think a lot of this stuff results in 1945 with the bringing the United Nations into effect to bring false Israel into effect. That's what I call a false Israel. But in 1948, when that false Israel came into effect, it brought all these other things into perspective as well. And ever since then, I believe that not only Great Britain, but America have been heading downhill. And I believe it all ties in with that because I believe that Jesus cursed that place. He said he'd leave it desolate. When he brought destruction, he told the disciples that they had 40 years to preach the word, and then they better get out of Jerusalem because it's going to be destroyed. And Matthew 24 was a result of all that that took place, the destruction of Israel and that Jewry and Judaism, and all this revival to bring all this back into effect has actually brought a curse, I believe, upon the British people and upon the American people as well, because these people lie and they say, you know, if you bless them, those who bless Israel, but Israel is really the people of the British colonies and of America as well.
That's true. And we've given away our birthright. We did in 1948 when we recognized what I call Israel lie, with heavy emphasis on the lie, instead of our own people as the true Israel of God, the white Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, and kindred peoples.
Yes, sir. And it's like, and the blessing is like, really, when they're, you know, these false Israel say they'll say, you know, to bless them, but really when America and Britain have been involved in blessing them, it's actually brought a curse back upon us.
True. In fact,
that's what I just wanted to say.
We're told we'll be blessed if we follow the law and we'll be cursed if we don't follow the law, and separation of the races is part of the law, and it said that you would have a stranger, in other words, somebody of another race, a Nazi, placed over you, and that's certainly what we have in this country. And it's an abomination with the black president and everybody else in a position of authority.
Yeah, they've turned it around on us. You know, the word British means sons of the covenant. And they turned the whole thing, they flipped the whole thing around on us, and, you know, they've got us blessing something that Jesus cursed. You know, I mean, most of the evangelical churches in America are these Zionist churches. They bless false Israel, and it brings a curse back upon America.
Yeah, I think there's been a double temptation that our political leaders, certainly here in London, fell for during the last century in endorsing the sort of thing that our caller's talking about there, in endorsing Christian Zionism, in endorsing the Zionist project. And here in London, I think the biggest temptation was that they our leaders were told by the leaders of Zionism, well, if you ally with us, we will prop up the British Empire's influence in certain corners of the world. We'll be a valuable ally for you in terms of international finance and in terms of literally on the ground in the Middle East. This happened in the First World War when we were fighting against the Ottoman Empire in that area, and certainly there was Freemasonic influence involved in this as well, were led to believe that an alliance with Zionism would help win that First World War battle against the Turks, against the Ottoman Empire. And then, in the aftermath of that, the deal in parceling up the old Ottoman Empire, the Zionists managed, through Lord Rothschild, to get their influence over the Balfour Declaration, get the British government to sign up to allying with Zionism. And then finally, after the Second World War again, most tragically, at the time of this United Nations vote, when some people here in the British government, including our own Foreign Secretary, were wanting to stand out against this, their policy was subverted, and a policy that could have helped Britain and America to form alliances in that region that could have helped us tremendously with when oil was discovered in parts of this region. You know, if we'd had an alliance with the various Arab countries of that region instead of the alliance with Zionism, we'd have been a heck of a lot better off both economically and militarily. But our leaders were subverted right at the top by these false promises that Zionism would help to sustain the declining influence of the British Empire. This was the temptation.
I was going to say, certainly during World War One, the Arabs were friendly towards us, and Lawrence of Arabia was not only you know, well known in the Arab world, but he opposed the Balfour Declaration, I understand.
Yeah, and this was the great tragedy of Lawrence's life. There's a division of opinion as to whether he killed himself in the end in despair at the way the Arabs had been betrayed, or whether he was actually murdered because people thought he could be an influence on British policy still in the 1930s because of his heroic reputation. But yeah, the Arabs were comprehensively betrayed by Britain's leaders, and Lawrence had drawn them into the great Arab revolt with all these promises that had been laid down to them by British representatives, while secretly other deals were being done. And of course, it's no wonder then that Britain gets this reputation around the world British leaders anyway get this reputation as perfidious Albion, as they used to say, of Britain being the great Satan, or the US as being the great Satan and Britain being the little Satan. This is what the Iranians used to call them, wasn't it, in the 80s. And it's no wonder that this reputation comes about when there's been this history of quite monstrous betrayal, and where we betray not only the Arabs who we've made promises to, but as one of your callers said a moment ago, we betray Christians in this region as well, because they're the people who end up at the sharp end of the absolutely disastrous consequences of mass bombings and illegal invasions. And we're only...
We've got got about a minute left, and I wonder if you had any parting comments.
Well, I would just say there are just some hopes that we still have of justice, of truth and justice prevailing. If people keep following the news about the Iraq war that we were talking about earlier, our political leaders, their duplicity, might just be exposed more fully in that matter. When their duplicity is exposed, when the lies are exposed on Iraq, that can be the wedge that's driven into the political establishment. People start to understand their leaders have been lying to them on matters as big as peace and war. Then perhaps our people will begin to understand the bigger picture of the lies that have been told to them literally for centuries.
Well, thank you very much for being our guest tonight. It's been a most interesting program.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Our contact information at the end. And if anybody would like to listen again to the program, it will be posted in the near future on our radio archive site. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a
CD
of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com, type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.